CD 7.
Crowley's London flat was the epitome of style. It was everything that a flat should be: spacious, white, elegantly furnished, and with that designer unlived-in look that only comes from not being lived in. This is because Crowley did not live there. It was simply the place he went back to at the end of the day when he was in London. The beds were always made, the fridge was always stocked with gourmet food that never went off. That was why Crowley had a fridge after all, and for that matter, the fridge never needed to be defrosted, or even plugged in. The lounge contained a huge television, a white leather sofa, a video, and a laser disc player. An answer phone, two telephones, the answer phone line and the private line, a number so far undiscovered by the legions of telephone salesmen who persisted in trying to sell Crowley double glazing, which he already had, or life insurance, which he didn't need. And a square, matte, black sound system, the kind so exquisitely engineered that it just has the on-off switch and the volume control. The only sound equipment Crowley had overlooked was speakers. He'd forgotten about them. Not that it made any difference. The sound reproduction was quite perfect anyway. There was an unconnected fax machine with the intelligence of a computer, and a computer with the intelligence of a retarded ant. Nevertheless, Crowley upgraded it every few months because a sleek computer was the sort of thing Crowley felt that the sort of human he tried to be would have. This one was like a Porsche with a screen. The manuals were still in their transparent wrapping. Along with the standard computer warranty agreement, which said that if the machine, one, didn't work, two, didn't do what the expensive advertisements said, three, electrocuted the immediate neighbourhood, four, and in fact failed entirely to be inside the expensive box when you opened it, this was expressly, absolutely, implicitly, and in no event the fault or responsibility of the manufacturer, that the purchaser should consider himself lucky to be allowed to give his money to the manufacturer, and that any attempt to treat what had just been paid for as the purchaser's own property would result in the attentions of serious men with menacing briefcases and very thin watches. Crowley had been extremely impressed with the warranties offered by the computer industry and had in fact sent a bundle below to the department that drew up the immortal soul agreements with a yellow memo form attached just saying, "Learn, guys." In fact, the only things in the flat Crowley devoted any personal attention to were the houseplants. They were huge and green and glorious with shiny, healthy, lustrous leaves. This was because once a week, Crowley went around the flat with a green plastic plant mister, spraying the leaves and talking to the plants. He had heard about talking to plants in the early 70s on Radio 4 and thought it an excellent idea. Although, talking is perhaps the wrong word for what Crowley did. What he did was put the fear of God into them. More precisely, the fear of Crowley. In addition to which, every couple of months, Crowley would pick out a plant that was growing too slowly, or succumbing to leaf wilt or browning, or just didn't look quite as good as the others, and he would carry it around to all the other plants, "Say goodbye to your friend," he'd say to them. He just couldn't cut it. Then he would leave the flat with the offending plant and return an hour or so later with a large, empty flower pot, which he would leave somewhere conspicuously around the flat. The plants were the most luxurious, verdant and beautiful in London, also the most terrified. The lounge was lit by spotlights and white neon tubes of the kind one casually props against a chair or corner. The only wall decoration was a framed drawing, the cartoon for the Mona Lisa, Leonardo da Vinci's original sketch. Crowley had bought it from the artist one hot afternoon in Florence and felt it was superior to the final painting. Leonardo had felt so too. "I got her bloody smile right in the roughs," he told Crowley, sipping cold wine in the lunchtime sun, "but it went all over the place when I painted it. Her husband had a few things to say about it when I delivered it, but, like I tell him, Signor del Giocondo, apart from you, who's going to see it? Anyway, explain this helicopter thing again, will you?" Crowley had a bedroom and a kitchen and an office and a lounge and a toilet, each room forever clean and perfect. He had spent an uncomfortable time in each of these rooms during the long wait for the end of the world. He had phoned his operatives in the Witchfinder Army again to try and get news, but his contact, Sergeant Shadwell, had just gone out, and the dim-witted receptionist seemed unable to grasp that he was willing to talk to any of the others. "Mr. Pulser is out too, love," she told him. "He went down to Tadfield this morning on a mission." "I'll speak to anyone," Crowley had explained. "I'll tell Mr. Shadwell that," she had said, "when he gets back. Now, if you don't mind, it's one of my mornings, and I can't leave my gentleman like that for..."